But who would build the roads? 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 But who would build the roads?
And now, it's time for the Freedom Fiends Agenda live call-in show. Have you swallowed too much of the state's poison? The Freedom Fiends will stick their fingers down your throat and hold your hair back while you hurl. Call in before they get droned. Right now, live on Freedom Fiends Radio.
Welcome to another episode of the Freedom Fiends Agenda, the Freedom Quaker Agenda, with Ben Stone and Michael W. Dean. How are you doing today, Ben?
I'm doing really good. Got some rest for once.
Yeah, me too. I got woken up by neighbors doing power tool kind of things outside my window, but then I napped when they took lunch. I napped for 2 hours, so I'm feeling feisty. How about you?
Pretty good, pretty good. Ready to go.
Nima returns from his journey to the Caribbean today. He'll be back in New Orleans for a day, and then back to Austin after that. And I threw my back out shoveling snow while he was sipping non-alcoholic drinks on a boat in the Caribbean. F that guy, man. F that guy.
That ain't right.
That ain't right. I'm a crab in a bucket. I'm going to pull him back down.
Yeah, but he's been working hard. He deserves a little break.
I guess. Oh, yeah. He has that other job that's like 50 hours a week. I forgot.
Yeah. Running his legs off.
Yeah. So the Fiends are looking for something. The Fiends are looking for people who are good at and have experience at cold calling. It's something that could make some money later, and it's not a telemarketing scam. It's basically helping us call radio stations, and then later the people who are good at it could be doing ad sales for the Fiends on commission, which could be kind of lucrative. So if there's anyone out there who's a Fiend who has done telemarketing, like literally I'm going to want to see your resume, drop me a line at talkback@freedomfiends.com. And if you have a resume, send me that. I'd like to see it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Nima took the 3 Bitcoins and fled to Mexico.
Well, right when they were peaked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could probably live a month there on 3 Bitcoins the day that they were $290,000 each or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember what they peaked out at, over 200, and then dropped down to just barely over 100 and started working their way back up.
Yeah, yeah. So,
and we're not going to say, you know, we're not going to make any kind of accusations as to what caused that, right?
Well, yeah, we can't prove it was George Soros, but that's the buzz. That's the buzz you're hearing in the background on the Fiends. No, that's... I don't know if it's a buzz, but, you know, he did that with the pound at one point, which, now, how would that not happen in a free market, or would it not be as devastating? I guess it would be less of a problem, first of all, because there wouldn't be one currency or one for each country, right?
Yeah, you know, it's probably a susceptible, because similar thing happened with silver in the early 80s, where a small group of people just purchased like crazy to drive the market up and then dumped it all. So I suppose in any kind of a market situation where there was no, interference, that would be a slight weakness, but you're always taking a pretty big chance. Like in this case, the theory is that a central bank or several central banks got together and took the hit by buying a lot of Bitcoins as they were going between 100 and 200. And then when they got to a certain point, dumped them all and took the hit for the specific purpose of trying to destroy the value of the Bitcoin. So in that sense, you know, it cost them maybe more than what they made out of it, unless you have one player. Like, we're not at all speculating that it was Soros, but somebody like that could have known that it was happening, ridden it up, dumped high, and been a part of it without actually losing anything.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it could happen in any market situation.
Yeah, there have been a lot of mention of tulips in relation to Bitcoin. Now, talk about the tulips and why that's not really relevant, or why that's why Kyle Bennett says that doesn't mean it's a bad thing because it didn't have anything to do with tulips, and people still bought tulips after that. But talk about the tulips.
The tulip boom was a really interesting thing in Holland, and that and the, it wasn't really just in Holland and the Netherlands. It was kind of a craze across Northern Europe.
All the cool markets, kids were doing it.
Yeah, it was a new thing that came in. A tulip was a new flower that came in from Turkey, and it grew really well in Northern Europe. So, and it was not like really any other flower that anybody had seen. So the value kept going up and going up. And there was a lot of speculation on it. And there were fortunes made. But then at some point, there was a saturation of the market and everybody could grow their own tulips. Oh. And it all collapsed. But like Kyle points out, even at its worst, tulips weren't free. They were still worth money.
Yeah.
So yeah, there. You know, you can have a speculation that drives it up unnaturally to a point. I can't remember the phrase Jeffrey Tucker called it the other day when I was talking to him, where he said that you have teenage girls sitting at the lunch table in school, chatting about Bitcoins on their cell phones. So sure, it's that. That crazy market where people are buying something that they don't even know what it is. So you're going to have a false signal like that. But then once that's over with and the thing levels back out, there's still really no mechanism in the market yet to tell us what the true value of Bitcoins is. It could be the value of Bitcoin could be $20, or the value of the Bitcoin could still be, like Jeffrey Tucker said, the value of a house. We don't know because it's not fully integrated into the system yet. And you can't really go out and just buy anything with a Bitcoin, you know, like you can dollars and euros and so forth. So we really don't know, even at this point, what the true value of the Bitcoin will be.
Kyle did an incredibly good article about it. Was that originally published on badquaker.com?
No, he put it on Facebook first.
Ew.
And then I immediately grabbed it and put it on Bad Quaker without his permission.
And then I reposted it as being from Bad Quaker and reposted it without permission on the Fiends blog.
Of course. Why would we ask permission?
It's called Killer Criticisms of Bitcoin That Are Really Just Flesh Wounds. And it's an amazing article. I like it.
Yeah, it really is good. And Kyle, you know, he put a lot of effort into it, and it really thoroughly goes through step by step of all the major arguments against Bitcoin and basically debunks them, or at least deals with them.
Yeah, yeah. I can see why. So Bitcoin has become a thing that, like, teenage girls are chatting about and texting on their phones. Is that true?
Yeah, that was what Jeffrey Tucker said that made it dangerous. But all that'll get burned away, you know, as soon as this imagined bubble is out of the way, and Bitcoin's become a real thing again, and not just something that's cool and hip.
Yeah, yeah. There's somebody named The State posting comments in here, and I can't really tell. Are they posting as what The State would say? That's funny when it's on. There's a Facebook page called The State, which I'm pretty sure is run by some libertarian, but, you know, he says, like, attended state college, works at state prison, you know, and everything statist he says he loves. Yeah, but good. The State is now known as Mango. I like The State better as Mango. Actually, if somebody got on here and just kept posting as The State, even though I know they were kidding, I think I'd give them a temporary timeout. Because it is.
You're so mean.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is my property. It's me and Nima's property, but Nima's in international waters, so he doesn't have claim. He's given me power of attorney while he's gone, maybe.
Power of attorney in a voluntary association.
Yes. He's going to come back, and I'm going to have all these, like, pending court arbitrations with people, pod beefs that he didn't even know of the people existed. Now, I've been really mellow, man. I've been just been working on getting ready to get us on radio. The latest I've heard is that our start date is going to be May 11th, and that this coming Tuesday, that's going to be etched in stone. And by like Thursday, it's going to be on the internal satellite feed list that radio stations only can see. And then we can start calling people. So, yay.
Cool.
Yay. Yeah, I've been working hard on that, getting all the contacts ready, getting all the bio information ready, getting everything fluffed and folded, working my butt off. And it's been good. It's also made me kind of mellow, actually. Just I don't have time or energy for pod beefs. I don't have time or energy for anything. Even my family, they're trying to bug me. I don't like them.
The Freedom Fiends is going to be like a brain virus that's going to infect the radio waves of the world and cause people to abandon the state and start to seek freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. Freedom. Interesting. Interesting. I have something I want to tell Ben, but it's secret. I could tell him in code.
Uh-oh.
The thing we were talking about before, which is kind of fun. The thing we were talking about before that someone was trying to drag me into.
That one thing with that guy.
Yeah. I actually got the impression that the one guy sending the email and CCing the other two people had the other two people behind him. But actually, one of the other people just CC'd back and kind of agreed with me of like, this is none of my business, which is kind of surprising. But I think it's, gotten to the point over the years with back and forth on this secret thing that, even the nanny people are like, I don't want to be nannying in this. This is just a clusterfuck.
Yeah, that's better. That's better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without sounding like we're some kind of describing some kind of a mafia hit or something like that. It's not. It's just.
I'm talking about my family.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's easier for me to talk about my family in the open than for you because my family are nuts. And so I can just mock them openly and call them by name and make fun of their stupidity.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't say that. Not all of my family is nuts. My oldest sister is pretty cool, and her husband's pretty cool. They have a nice farm in eastern Kentucky, and they're really nice people.
Yeah, I don't hate. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to give a shout out to Appalachia. There's a lot of nice people in eastern Kentucky, as long as you're one of them.
You mean as long as you're from there?
Yeah, as long as they recognize your name or have some association with you in some way and know who you are, they're really, really nice. But a lot of them are really suspicious of outsiders, and for good reason.
Yeah, because outsiders are usually feds who want to take their still or marijuana farms or Bitcoin mining operations away from them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there is a lot of all that still going on in eastern Kentucky, too.
Including Bitcoin mining?
I don't know about Bitcoin.
Probably at the college.
I don't know if they're really
at the college or something. Yeah,
I'll bet there are. There's a lot of tech savvy people in Eastern Kentucky, and
oh, those aren't rednecks. Those are hillbillies. I'm sorry.
Yes,
there's a difference.
Yes, there's a distinguishing difference.
People often don't see the difference in those two things. Those are hillbillies, not rednecks. There's a big difference, or at least if you ask them, there is. And some of both of those camps use those terms on themselves. And would be a little insulted if you used the other term on them.
Yeah, and there's some overlap too.
Yeah, there's a book that I've recommended before. I'll recommend again. It's by Jim Goad. Yeah, Mike Makes Right, my friend from California that I used to be in a band with. The only person I used to be in a band with that I'm not only on speaking terms with, but like love to talk to and talk to. I don't talk to him on the phone as much as I talk to Ben on the phone, but I would if he had time. He's busy as a beaver. And so he turned me on to this guy named Jim Goad, who wrote this book called The Redneck Manifesto. And it was kind of my first real inkling. It was about 10 years ago. It was kind of my first real inkling at kind of quasi-libertarian thought. Now, Jim Goad is a really interesting study because he is... absolutely not minarchist, but he's not quite fully libertarian. He does essays that are great for a magazine called Talkies Mag, Takimag, T-A-K-I-M-A-G. And his essays are great. His book, Redneck Manifesto, is great. I didn't really like his other books. I felt like he blew his wad on the Redneck Manifesto. But then now he's writing really good. He's actually great at short form essay, you know, 3 or 4 page things. Social commentary. He's not so much libertarian as he hates Republicans and Democrats equally and incredibly hates them, hates them, hates them. He was also the first person I ever read who I liked who talked about gun ownership being good. Why would anyone trust the federal government? And what was his other thing? The idea that tax protesters are not lunatics, although the press likes to paint them that way. And I'm not a tax protester, but I used to really buy the Kool-Aid. I read a lot, but I read a lot of fiction and I read a lot of tech manuals my whole life. And I never really read a lot. I believed what was fed to me on the tube. And, you know, when you'd have some pundit saying, and these tax protesters hate the federal government and have guns and they're horrible people and should be, you know, it's a good thing they burned down their house down. The government intervened and burned down their house in Waco because they're bad people, obviously, or the government wouldn't have needed to burn down their house and kill them. And that made total sense to me. I'm really kind of embarrassed to say it, but in the teaching hospital spirit of the Freedom Fiends, I have no problem saying it. And I'm kind of happy to say it because it goes back to that thing of, you know, there were some people who are born anarchists. I think your daughter Kai is one of them, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, she's and I've always had I've always not liked authority. You know, when I was 5 years old, I was screaming at the kindergarten teacher telling her she was wrong and I was right, but I got in trouble for it. But I went through, you know, 25, 30 years of my life where I was voting and voting wrong. Well, not voting for 25 years, but, you know, believing what I was told by the media. And I feel nothing against Kai, but I feel like someone who's been a statist and now is a recovering statist and an unstatist, for a lot of people, that has more value in helping others get away from statism than someone who's always been an anarchist. It's kind of the same way that a recovering alcoholic can help an alcoholic get off of alcohol more than someone who's been a teetotaler their whole life. Because the teetotaler doesn't understand. They just say, oh, why don't you not drink as much? Or why don't you not drink? Or, you know, or if they're moralistic, there's something wrong with you because you can't stop drinking. Whereas the recovering alcoholic who's sober can, you know, they're not... Not Kai's a bad example for this because I don't want to say like she's that, but she just was someone I thought of who was born anarchist, and some people are. But the recovering statist, it's more like the alcoholic who can, instead of pointing down at you, like, you know, here's what I heard in AA when I first went in, and it makes a lot of sense. The value of a recovering alcoholic helping an alcoholic who wants to stop drinking is far greater than someone with a PhD in alcoholism who's never been an alcoholic, or a judge pointing their finger down at you, pointing their superior Catholic finger down at you, to paraphrase an album title by Helios Creed that I like a lot, or a spouse begging up to you, please, please stop. You know, it's not pointing down at you. It's not pointing up at you. It's looking across the table into your eyes with a cup of coffee for each of you and just going like, hey, man, I was like you, you know. And that's why people tell in the beginning of a share in AA, they tell what it was like and then they say what happened and then what it's like now. The first part of that, the what it was like, has only one purpose. It's not to entertain. It's not to outdo the other guy. It's so the new guy coming in the door who's got, you know, 0 days sober or 1 day sober or 2 days sober. So that guy knows he's in the right place. So he knows these people are like me, because alcoholics have this kind of delusion where they either think they don't have a problem, which a lot of statists think they don't have a problem, or a lot of alcoholics and some statists think, well, I have a problem, but you people weren't like me, so you can't help me. And Freedom Fiends is the AA group for recovering statists, and telling the fact that I used to watch the news, you know, as little as like 10 years ago, I used to watch the news and go, yeah, those people are bad, and that's why the government's after them, and they should take their guns away, and we need more laws. And I was really lazy. Telling that helps the new guy coming in the door, and it helps people with their journey. And my journey was really quick. Like 10 years, you know, I've only been a I became a minarchist about 5 years ago. It was basically when we bought guns, and someone tried to break in our house, so we bought guns. And then I got some gun books, and Amazon said, oh, people who bought this book, I got books on gun laws because I lived in California, and I wanted to know, you know, all that was kind of a thing for me, was all of a sudden realizing I'm not a bad person, but if I'm not careful, I'm going to break the law and I could end up in jail. So, you know, I had learned things like how to lock up your mags and your ammo and your gun separately in separate containers and then lock them in your trunk so you could drive legally to a range 20 miles away and shoot. So I'd never had experience with anything like that except drugs. And when I was doing drugs many, many years ago, like I've been clean since 94, many years ago, I didn't even realize they were illegal. I mean, I knew they were, but it didn't internalize. Like, I remember actually standing on the street corner, broad daylight, and a friend of mine saying, you know, you have a loaded capped syringe behind your ear sticking out of your hair. You know, like, it didn't occur to me. And so with guns, you know, that was kind of my path to liberty. Like, I got the law books, and then I got the book You and the Police by Boston Tea Party. And I learned two things from that. One was there's a place called Wyoming and you can legally open carry a gun without a permit there. To which, you know, 6 hours later, I woke my wife up an hour early and said, honey, we're moving to Wyoming. And 11 months later, we lived here. And the second thing I learned was that there are good laws and bad laws. You know, there's mala prohibita and mala in se. There's laws that everyone would agree are bad laws. You don't murder people. You don't steal, etc. I mean, it basically introduced me to the idea of the non-aggression principle without even using those terms. And then the other kind of law is the, you know, mala prohibita, prohibited because I say so, which it seems to me that there are about 6 or 8 laws that are legitimate and the other million laws are, you know, because I say so laws. And that was my journey. That was the beginning of my journey. And I still clung to the idea of, well, there shouldn't be as many laws and we should be freer, but we need some laws and some government and some police and some military because people are bad and we need, you know, I hadn't listened to any media yet, like Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, or Stefan Molyneux, to learn ways that people could organize society without pointing guns at people. And, but in between 10 years ago and 5 years ago, I was still a lazy statist, but I wasn't buying it as much. I was kind of like, yeah, everybody's effed. That was kind of my attitude towards it. That was the pre-minarchist me. The post full-on statist, pre-minarchist me was just having this vague feeling that everyone in control or in the media or in power was wrong. So how about you, Ben?
Well, first, let me just point out that somebody in the chat had a great statement here. He says, let me find it.
Go ahead. You found it.
It felt great to be a statist. I had my team and knew all the talking points.
Yeah.
And when he said that, you were talking about comparing it to alcoholism or drug addiction or whatever. And, you know, really it is very much like being in a bar where you've got all your friends there, everybody's saying the same stuff, and you might be saying like, you know, oh, the Red Sox are best, oh, the Yankees are best, but all that's just chatter, and it's part of the fun of being at the bar and being with all your friends and arguing about which team is the best or who's going to the Super Bowl or who's, you know, all that stuff is part of the game, and it's part of making you feel like you're part of it and one of the, you know, one of the team and everything like that. And then to realize that that is 100% a con and that you're just being played, you're just being toyed with. It has a tendency to hit a person in different ways according to the person. And like you're talking about there, it can hit you like, you know, we're screwed. We have no chance. It's a loss. What are we going to do? Hunker down, you know, hide by guns and wait till they bang on the door, or, you know, it's all according to how it strikes that person. But, you know, it can really be devastating, or it can be enlightening or angering. I see some people react, you know, in a way that they want to immediately take up arms against the state. And I've felt that way at times, but that's maybe as bad or worse than the other options, because, you know, it'll just crush you. It doesn't care. It'll Waco you without even thinking about it.
It'll Waco you. And I don't even know that that's what Waco, the people at that place, had in mind.
Right.
They were leave me aloneers. You know, they weren't destroy the government. They wanted to be left alone, and the government destroyed them. So if the government back then, as primitive as it was compared to now, they didn't have drones back then. They went in with tanks. They would drone them now. As primitive as the government was back then, you know, relatively speaking to now technologically, and advancements of more laws and other wonderful progress and progressivenessism, you know, if they would do that to someone who wasn't even really... they weren't even really anti-government. They were more extra government, like beyond, like, we don't want any part of that, you know? If they would do that to them back then, think what they do now to someone who actually wants to take up arms against the government. They would just crush them like a bug. And actually, bug is the proper term, because bug splat is the drone operator vernacular for what it looks like from the drone when the missile hits the person and splatters them all over the road.
Mm, isn't that sick?
Mm-hmm.
That is really twisted.
Well, the title of today's episode, we're going to get into that in a sec here. I have one more thing to say about the AA analogy. The title of today's episode is Beware of Those in Whom the Urge to Punish is Strong. So I wanted to get back to the AA thing first. One more thing about it. I guess we're still talking about it. It's not getting back to it, but I want to finish up with it. I'll go you one further than saying alcohol, you know, statism is like being with your buddies in the bar, all agreeing on the sports team or something. I, on more than one occasion when I was drinking and really bad alcoholic, sat in a bar with a bunch of people, raised my glass and made a toast to alcoholism. And toasting alcoholism, it's kind of interesting because in AA, one of the steps is, you know, admitting you were wrong, admitting you have a problem. That's the first step. And the wording of it in the extended form of that is concede to your innermost self that you have a problem. Now, there's a difference between saying you're an alcoholic, which is me at the bar toasting my alcoholism with people and them agreeing. There's a difference between that and conceding to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic. Because conceding to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic is realizing absolutely and without question that because you're an alcoholic, you will drink until you die. An early, painful, horrible death, and destroy a lot of people's lives on the way. Toasting to your alcoholism is not conceding to your innermost self that you have a problem. It's joking about it and making light of it, and it's not any step toward recovery. Making a list of ways you've harmed other people is part of really realizing, you know, you don't just do that in AA to know who to make amends to. You do it to really prove to yourself, like, yeah, I spent the rent money on alcohol. You know, I broke the window because I was drunk. I crashed my bicycle into a gravestone riding through the graveyard and, you know, fractured my elbow. You know, if you write down 500 or 600 of those things, you can really read it back. You read it back to your sponsor and you go, yeah, I guess I really am an alcoholic, and I will, if I continue to drink, it will kill me early and painfully and take other people down and destroy their lives on the way. So, yeah, like Pooplicated said, internalization is hard. So the primary purpose of the fiends, I would say, is to help people get off statism. And part of that is admitting to your innermost self that you have a problem with statism. And I think that, you know, we do that a lot of ways. We do it with humor. We do it with analogy. We do it with storytelling, you know, little morality plays about the state. We do it with memes. We do it with what happened to us today. We do it with what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Three-act format, AA, share. And I'm going to pass the mic over to Ben here.
That's really kind of, well, going back to my last talk with Jeffrey Tucker, we talked about how, what was it he was talking about? Oh, he was talking about IP rights and how it had devastated the music industry starting from about 1900 or so. And he told like a little story, essentially. I don't think he really meant to tell a story, but that's what he was doing. And he told a story how with Gregorian chant, essentially it kept, during the Dark Ages, it kept music alive as a, you know, when people were too poor to buy instruments and the economy was down for hundreds of years at a time, Gregorian chant was something that you could still have beautiful music, even setting aside its religious connotations. It was still fantastically beautiful music.
It was the pop song of its day.
Yeah, and it was modified every single time. From one location to the other, they would take it and make it their own for that particular location, and it was alive like that all the way up until 1900, when it was all written out in two competing music books, and they both copyrighted, and now all of a sudden the door was slammed, and for 100 years. The music of the Catholic, and I'm not Catholic, I'm just, you know, relaying the story. So for 100 years, the music of the Catholic Church was stale and ugly and pathetic and pitiful. And then like in the 60s, right in the middle of all that, people started breaking out guitars and singing folk music, because essentially anything was better than that stale toast that they were serving up as music.
You know? Yeah.
And now eventually, now here we are in the 21st century, 100 years has gone by of staleness. And Jeffrey Tucker is speaking at the Vatican this July and explaining to them why they need to reject intellectual property and allow music to be free again within the Catholic Church. So it's kind of like, when he was telling the story, I was like, that's redemption in the third act. That is living, you were living in a sort of a, not a utopia, but you were living in a Garden of Eden, and then there was the falling away, there was the sin, the eating of the apple of the state by accepting copyright on music. And then there was 100 years of punishment and drudgery and struggle. And now finally there's redemption in the third act as freedom comes back again.
Yeah. I think the music industry is a good analogy for the state. And here's why. There was no music industry before a little over 100 years ago. Thomas Edison invented it. And he also invented it while destroying competition in an illegal way, in an unfair way, legally using the state. And they actually had, what's the term? Format wars. You know how we've had format wars, like, I guess Mac versus PC, but they both kind of won out. But we've had format wars like Beta versus VHS, 8-track versus cassette, or not even, Beta versus VHS is a better example, because it was the same thing, but two different formats of it made by different companies, and each person's playing device, you know, the cartridge, didn't work in the other person's player. And that's a problem with copyright and with patents. And it just leads to, here's what it leads to. Beta is a technologically better format than VHS, but VHS won out. That's what you get. That's one of the downfalls of intellectual property, is you end up with worse technology. There are many other problems with it. But the music industry did not exist. There weren't even copyrights per se on the first Edison records, but it's like if you wanted a record, you had to buy it from Edison. There was no way to copy it at home. He didn't really need copyrights on it because he owned the technology. And all of a sudden, there was a music industry. All of a sudden, music had worth other than someone standing up and singing it, and it's gone when you're done. And for about 100 years, it ruled. The music industry ruled. And then some 18-year-old stoner in his dorm room invented this little program called Napster.
And the cat was out of the bag.
And the cat will not go back in the bag, basically. And they tried passing more laws. They tried doing this. They tried doing that. They tried crushing it. They finally bought out Napster and turned it into a really boring pay service that actually still exists. I don't know if you know this or people know this, but Napster is kind of like iTunes. You go there to buy music and nobody uses it because it was a really bad plan to take something where everything was free and instant and you could get all of it all the time and turn it into a pay service. You know, this is an interesting thing about why people, I think why people buy, I mean, use pirated services, you know, for software, music, movies. It's not just because it's free. It's not just because you feel like you're sticking it to the man, which is the reason a lot of people do it. I mean, there are people who actually download torrents of things they're never going to use and share them for the sheer purpose of sticking it to the man. They're not even necessarily anarchists. Some of them are statists. Some of them are leftists. Some of them are leftist anarchists. But there's a lot of people who do that just because it kind of feels like power. You know, if you're 14 and your dad's yelling at you, you can go upstairs and take it out on the music industry and actually screw up some people's lives who've been screwing up other people's lives for years. So one of the reasons people use pirated stuff isn't just because it's free or you're sticking to the man. It's actually better. Now, I've never used any pirated software or music or videos. I would never do that. But I've talked to people who have or read about them talking about it. And here's the difference. When you want to watch a TV show, you make an appointment. You have to be in a certain place at a certain time. You sit down and watch TV, and you have to wait through the commercials. When you download stuff, all the commercials are edited out. And if there's something you like, you can get every episode of every season of it in one sitting and watch it in one weekend. And that's the way a lot of people like to consume media rather than waiting for it to come out. With pirated software, when you go to install software you buy, you have to enter a code. You have to wait for it to connect and go, you know, phone home to the company that makes it and have them authorize it back. And if their servers are down, you can't use what you already paid for. You have to, you know, it'll try to update. It'll try to add, you know, it'll put ads sometimes. It'll try to sell you things. It'll put you on a mailing list. When you get pirated software, it works. You usually don't have to enter a serial number. Sometimes you do, but it works 100% of the time with the good ones. And you don't need to deal with another entity. If the company server's down, you can still use it. You don't have to jump through all the hoops. You know, people make stuff in a way that works. Ooh, I have mail. I'll be right back. Talk, Ben.
Yeah, my little, if you want to put it this way, my story, my testimony in reference to music in that field was that, you know, I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, and a lot of FM radio. FM radio was about it. Yeah, that was everything, and especially in the 70s, FM radio was everything. AM, only squares listened to AM radio, so everything was on FM. And even FM radio pretty much only played albums. Very few live albums. Mostly FM radio played the standard album music. And so years went by, and I had pigeonholed the Allman Brothers right in there with all other Southern rock, which it's okay.
Yeah, they're special.
Well, yeah, I found that out later.
They also invented guitar harmonies in rock music, pretty much.
But see, I wasn't into any of that stuff because all I ever heard was their basic four or five, you know, radio-friendly songs.
Sweet Melissa, and they were, Whipping Post.
Yeah. And even Whipping Post, the standard radio version of it, is quite bland. But it wasn't up until the internet came along and you could go on and just grab large quantities of pirate music that
so,
I ever
so we've
bothered.
Heard.
Yeah.
I got cat toys, man, and kitty cat crack. What's it called? Catnip. Things are going to get noisy in here.
And jingle bells. But it was only after that this stuff became to where you could just rip it off of the internet and start listening to it that I ever heard any of the Allman Brothers live. And I started hearing their stuff live, and I was like, man, this is nothing like what was on the radio. You hear the Whipping Post live, where it goes on for like literally like, you know, what is it, 18 minutes or something?
Yeah.
And that is a work of art.
Frank Zappa covered it too. You ever heard Frank Zappa cover Whipping Post? Pretty awesome.
I have, yeah. Yeah. Yep. But that's the difference between, you know, what is canned and what is served to you on a little metal plate with a metal spoon and what is, you know, really out there that's available. I would have never, if I'd lived 100 years, I never would have bought an Allman Brothers album. But now I have actually purchased Allman Brothers albums only because I heard them in pirate version.
I actually know that you purchased them because you purchased them with the Freedom Fiends Amazon link.
Aha.
And you, and then you told me that you did it. So, yeah, Freedom Fiends and Ben Quaker, Bad Stone, have Amazon links where you can go and click, and we get pennies, and you pay nothing. It helps.
Yeah, it does
help. I bought this mixer, the Nabtron 9000, through Ben's affiliate link.
And I bought my mixer. Well, actually, my wife bought my mixer through Michael's link.
Yeah.
And then Michael spent all day yesterday, I mean like all day yesterday, on the phone with me, working through software, through hardware issues to get the sound that you're hearing right now.
Well, not the sound you're hearing right now, because you're hearing it squished through Mumble and then through a little wire going through Butt streaming, which is not the best sound. But the next, are you doing a cast tomorrow, a non-interview solo cast tomorrow?
No, I think I'm going to take the weekend off. I've been working pretty hard, so I think I'm going to
take off till Monday. Next week, Ben is going to sound even better. You did some tests yesterday and sent me the file, and it was literally the best thing, the best audio I've ever heard of you. It was stunning. It was like NPR, but commanding and with an edge and with depth and with gravitas.
And this is Ben Stone on NPR.
And this is Ben Stone. Yeah. Charlie is making love to a little stuffed, a little banana toy, fabric banana toy that is stuffed with catnip. I imagine the other cats will come in here pretty soon and discover this cornucopia of stuff on the floor and start making love to it also. So the state. So I was saying about the state. The music industry responded by, you know, to this threat of file sharing with a bunch of laws. And they had some high profile, you know, they busted some 8-year-old girl and fined her mother $500,000. Things like that, that really, in the long run, just make them look like Mr. Burns. It just makes them look like what people already thought they were, which is a faceless, heartless corporation. You know, Bank of America, in their headquarters are in San Francisco at 555 California, or as the bike, we call it as bike messengers, Triple Nickel Cal. There is a piece of bank art. You know bank art, right? You know what bank art is. You know, yep. It's big, ugly, gaudy, expensive, seems to serve no purpose. In California, I think there's actually a law that there has to be a certain amount of bank art. I know there's a law that there has to be a certain amount of public art. And there's a 1% tax added on to the tax on hotel rooms there that goes strictly to public art, to, you know, socialist workers of the world unite public art. But there's a thing in front of 555 California that I'm going to post a picture of. It's called, the nickname for it is Banker's Heart. It is a sculpture that is a giant black cold piece of stone. And yeah.
Wow. There was a frenzy that took place. I watched it, with much interest. Starting in the late 90s and early 2000s, there was just a frenzy among lawmakers, put that in quotes, lawmakers, to kill this thing that terrified them, that people were going on this new internet and sharing files like crazy, and this was just going to bring destruction to humanity. But you could tell there was two things driving it. One was the greed of non-artists who were in control of the product of the artists, and two, it was just the deep desire of a small group of people to lord over another group of people because for the sheer fact that they appeared to be enjoying themselves. There's somebody out there having fun. We have to crush this. Yeah. H.L. Mencken said, how was it? I'm going to destroy his quote, but it was something like, a Puritan is a person who is deathly afraid that somewhere, somehow, there's someone having fun.
Which will lead to the title of today's cast, Beware of People in Whom the Strong to Punish, the desire to punish is strong. The thing about the state and the thing about the analogy I have with the state for the music industry is the music industry had a really good run. You know, if you were in the music industry, especially at the corporate level rather than at the musician level, you had about 100 years of just basically printing money and ripping off creative people. And when Napster came along and then later BitTorrent, which was much more efficient and better and untrackable if done correctly, you know, through a VPN using peer block and private browsing, or so I've heard. That's what I read somewhere. Basically, it undoes the ability of the music industry to have a monopoly on a particular piece of music. And the music industry is still overreacting to this and still upset. And they kind of act like a dinosaur thrashing in the tar pits as they're going extinct. And the thing is, they thought it would last forever. There's a quote from the Eagles I really liked. It was from the 80s. I had it up on my wall, the quote in big letters from Rolling Stone magazine from an interview with the Eagles, to remind me when I got signed to Warner Brothers that it wouldn't last forever. And the quote was, "The drugs were strong, the women were beautiful, and we thought it would last forever." And that's not just the Eagles story, but that's kind of the story of the music industry. And they really felt like, since it had lasted 100 years, that they had a right to keep doing it. And technology kind of superseded those rights to where, you know, Paul Bonneau says there aren't really rights. There's only what you can fight to keep. And the music industry can't fight to keep it. They can put, you know, 1/1000th of 1% of the people who file share in jail or fine them a lot of money, but they can't stop it. And outlawing things actually makes them bigger, makes them more common. With drugs, it makes them more common because, you know, people have a financial incentive to do whatever it takes to protect their corner. With Bitcoin, if they try to outlaw it, the few people still doing it are going to be millionaires because the price is going to go way up for each Bitcoin. And with file sharing, basically, there's not the financial incentive. The incentive is, you don't want me to do this, so I'm going to do it. I mean, that's what drives a lot of file sharing, other than the convenience of it. And the music industry, as we know it, is on its way out. It's completely on its way out. And it's still thrashing in the tar pits saying, no, I have a right to exist. And here's my long-winded summation of this analogy. That's what the state is doing, and I believe technology can help undo the state the same way it undid the music industry. Ben?
I think so. I believe so. I'm convinced of that. I was talking to, I'm really embarrassed that his name has escaped me, but it'll come jumping back in a second. I was talking to a guy that wrote a book back in like 91 or something like that. And in it, he coined the phrase, the iron law of prohibition. And he, in that, he's talking about how any time that a government outlaws something, it doesn't matter what it is, what they end up doing is they make it more expensive to transport it and you know, the dangers of transporting it and distributing it and producing it and everything. So it concentrates it into a stronger formula, if you can think of it that way. And a lot of money is made in that process. So what you actually do is you promote it more than you put it down, and you create a stronger product. So my example of that is brandy. Wine was being transported around the, you know, medieval Europe, and little principalities here and there decided to start laying taxes per barrel on wine, and so wine producers were like, you know, this tax is getting to be a real pain. So what do we do about it? It wasn't necessarily prohibition, but tax is a form of, it's an interruption in the market. It's a natural interruption in the market. So it's like a prohibition. And if a tax is so burdensome, it is a prohibition. So the winemakers thought, okay, well, if they're going to tax us per barrel of wine, then what we'll do is we'll make the barrels larger and we'll distill the wine before we put it in the barrels. So instead of you having a barrel of wine that was maybe 10% alcohol, you've got a barrel of wine that's twice as big and it's like 40% alcohol. And then they could get it to the destination where they were going and water it back down if there was the desire to water it back down. But lo and behold, people liked it at 40% alcohol. And so that's where the word brandy wine came from. It was literally means burned wine. So it was the attempt at prohibition that caused the product to go from small barrels to large barrels of 40 proof instead of 10 proof.
Well, there also wasn't crystal meth with, you know, above 95% purity in the 70s like there is now, because they've cracked down on it so hard. It's not so much an incentive to make a better product, although that's part of it, but I think that it's an incentive to make a more transportable product, you know? If you outlaw opium, people are going to turn it into morphine and heroin because it's a lot smaller to ship and it doesn't smell as much.
I use that example with meth all the time. When in the late 70s, I was really into the drug scene and was making my living with it. And, you know, there was all kinds of meth available, but very few people wanted anything to do with it. It was nasty. And really only one person I know that I knew back then, he's dead now, of course, but only one person I knew back then really even liked meth. But then, you know, because of the market shift and because of the crackdowns on cocaine specifically and marijuana as well through the 80s with the so-called drug war, by the 90s, you know, a lot of people were cooking meth and it was way more available in the market. And by the 2000s, you know, the purity level had really gone up and it's really more addictive and it's really more devastating to people's lives. And it's far more available by the 2000s than, you know, than it would be if the government had just not worried about it, left it alone, not made a big deal about it. Plus, by them cracking down on the local production of it, by, you know, busting the local mom and pop shops that were making it, they've driven the production into the hands of Mexican and Central American cartels that can produce it in mass and ship it in. You know, if you're a drug smuggler and you've got the choice, what am I going to smuggle across the American border? You know, 10 pounds of marijuana that takes up a whole backpack.
Yeah.
Or, you know, basically a fistful of meth that's going to net me twice as much money and I can hide it pretty much anywhere.
Yeah. Yep. Yep, 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 yep. I just switched microphones. I just got my new microphone from UPS, and it's a SM58. It's an even cheaper microphone than the one that you and I use, and it's the same one Nima uses. I've always wanted one, and I got one. I sold my ribbon mic. I'm also selling a couple condenser mics. If people want to own some Fiends history, you can get it, and there's a post on the Fiends blog. So how does it sound, people?
Sounds good. So the magic man in the brown van visited you.
Yep. After the post office guy visited me, brought me the cat toys. Yeah, there's generally just, I like to shop over the internet. There's generally like a line of delivery trucks outside of my house.
Magic man in the brown happy van.
Yep. So let's play a little music and take a breaky break here. I'm going to cue up something. And we will go our separate ways for about 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes. No, 5 minutes. Let's see what we got. What do we want to hear? A Ben Quaker podcast? No, some music. It might be only in one ear. I can't help that. It's I'm out of cables. I need to buy more cables. Death Clock's always good, but we played this song. Let's see what else we got. Nima Vedati. Oh, Ward's Weapon Factory. This song's pretty short. I'll play something else after it. But this is a great song. It's a punk rock song from the 80s from a a band from Vermont called Wards, W-A-R-D-S, and this song is called Weapons Factory, and it's about the weapons factory, you know, the U.S. military, they only supply the U.S. military. They make missiles in the town where this band's from, so I'm going to play this. Yeah, boy. Yeah.
Weapon factory, weapon factory, weapon factory, weapon factory, weapon factory.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
If you like tranny hookers and shooting crocodile, tune in to FreedomFiends.com.
Want to contribute to Liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding Fiends episodes and DVDs to help keep us drone-proof. There's a Torrent Club link at the top of FreedomFiends.com. There you'll find our Torrent RSS feed and instructions to grab past episodes and automatically download new ones, even while you're away from the computer. You'll also get special episodes of The Fiends and Anarchy Gumbo days or even weeks before regular podcast subscribers who aren't torrenting. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding The Fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down. Love The Fiends and want to help out? We do take donations and we put them back into our Liberty projects. You can make a donation by clicking on the spinning coin on any post. But what if you want to help, but you ain't got no cash? Or you made a donation and you want to help more? Here's how you can help. Download and seed our torrents to help keep us drone-proof. There's a Torrent Club link at the top of FreedomFiends.com. You can also blog The Fiends and share episode links on Facebook, Twitter, and elsewhere. You can rate and review our movies on Amazon and IMDb. You can rate and review The Freedom Fiends and Anarchy Gumbo and our songs on iTunes. That really helps a lot. You can buy our movies and share them with friends or give them out as gifts. And one of the best ways to spread liberty is to buy a bunch of Freedom Fiends buttons and give them out as gifts. Wholesale prices are available, and you can also comment on our site, or better yet, comment about us on other sites. And please email the site link to all your friends. Thanks for helping spread The Fiends message worldwide to as many liberty people as you can, especially to those who don't yet get it. You rock.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've been on the World Wide Web since its inception in 1994. I've tried dozens of web providers in that time. The only one that hasn't broken my heart is HostGator. HostGator has unlimited server space, unlimited throughput, and a guaranteed uptime of better than 99.9% for only $150 a year. You can pay a little less elsewhere, but you'll pull out your hair dealing with anyone else. HostGator has great service and unlimited tech support, only a phone call away, 24/7, 365. HostGator is where pros like The Fiends host, because we know how to do it right. Go to FreedomFiends.com and click on the HostGator affiliate link on the right sidebar to sign up today.
Did you hear that, Ben? Are you still there? Are you still with us? Oh, I think I turned Ben down. Hi, Ben.
Uh-oh.
You there?
Hey.
All right.
Am I there now?
Yeah.
Also, you didn't hear that I said that was with Sonny and Cher doing backup vocals.
Kind of sounded like it, but it wasn't. Yeah. Winnebago Warrior. Kill some fish down by the creek. Show your grandson who's the boss. Do you do that? Do you kill fish at the creek to show your grandson who's the boss?
I'm not much of a fisherman. My wife likes to fish.
I liked to fish when I was about, I don't know, kind of until I discovered girls, I think. I'm vaping. Can you hear it with this new mic? Listen.
I can't hear it. Oh, I can hear it clicking.
Yeah. The creamy fiend sound. I think I like this mic better. I'm going to write blog articles about how everyone should be using the cheapest mic possible. No, actually, everyone should use this mic. See, here's two revelations. One is I needed to own a Shure SM58 because it's the mic I used everywhere all the time when I was in a band. Every club has one of these on stage pretty much, SM57 or 58. And usually a 58 because it doesn't hurt your teeth as much when people slam dance into you because it's got a ball instead of a rim. So I like it. It's distorting a little bit. What's going on here? What's going on? I just butt casting is just not ideal. That's the problem. So, oh man, my cats are flipping out. They're all in a line about 20 feet apart playing with their drug toys. So I wanted one of these mics because it's a big part of my past. I spent about 20 years screaming into one. The second thing is I remembered being at Howard University, which is America's premier African-American university, in Washington, D.C., when I was a homeless punk rocker in 1984. And I'd go to the library there and just hang out all day and read because I had nowhere to really go. And I was broke and I was alcoholic and I was worried about my future. I was like, what am I going to be doing when I'm almost 50? And my fantasy was that I would be married to someone I love, happy, living somewhere, not in a city. That was part of it. And making a living, doing what I love, and reaching the world for my home. That was my goal. I remember thinking that in a library. And I had that Dead Kennedy song or some that album playing in my head. I think I borrowed a friend's Walkman and was listening to it. So I have met and exceeded all my dreams. That's all I got to say about that.
And that's all I have to say about that.
How about you,
but
Ben?
Now, Michael,
yeah?
How do you know that you're not actually so brain damaged from alcoholism that you're straitjacketed in a hospital and it's really still 1999 and all this is happening in a fantasy in your mind?
Because the Fiends would have more fans in a fantasy.
Ah, there you go.
We have a good number of fans, but if it were all in my head, Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and all the people from MSNBC would be begging to come on my talk show. And I'd be like,
I can always,
sorry, I don't talk to nobodies. I've never heard of you.
I can always tell if I'm dreaming or not because I pick up something or I look at something to read. And if I can't read it, I know I'm dreaming.
Huh. I don't do that kind of, what's it called, lucid dreaming. I don't challenge myself in dreams to see if they're dreaming or not. I think I'm pretty aware that they're dreams. And what I'm really good at is if things are really unpleasant, I wake up. I didn't used to when I was younger, but that's what I think I've subconsciously trained myself to do is bail. Like, I don't want to deal with this crap, man. People are dying and my mom's alive and yelling at me.
I have dreams of like being in my house, sitting in my chair, walking around, looking out the window, where everything is so realistic. There's no indication whatsoever for me to think that it's not real. And then something will happen that's just slightly off, and I'll be like, this is not supposed to be here. Like, a wall will be in the wrong place or something. And so I'll start looking around for something to read. Usually, once I realize that it is a dream, I'll go ahead and let it flow. But I just need to verify that, and then if it starts getting weird, I can always just step out of it. Usually, not always. Sometimes it's not that easy.
Yeah. Mew.
But then again, that's what brain damage does to you. Well, actually, what is it? The line from Beetlejuice? No. This is what death is for you, for that person over there. That's what death is for them. It's all very personal. I bungled the line.
Talk about your brain damage. Do you need a conservatorship?
Possibly at some point.
Yeah, but you got family that would take care of you gladly instead of fighting to put you in a home.
Yeah. Yeah, they know better than that. That would be a problem. They'd be better to turn me out on the streets. No, in all seriousness, I've had in excess of 35 concussions, and I say it that way for a reason. I used to keep count.
And when I got to about 35, I thought, this is stupid. I talked to a doctor and I'm like, I have, you know, 36.
Well, if you can count how many concussions you've had, you haven't had that many concussions, I'd say.
Yeah. But at some point it becomes a moot point, the number, because it's like, okay, what's the difference between 27 and 31 concussions? And when you're telling this to a doctor and he's like, you know, he's either going to believe your story or he's not going to believe your story, and the number difference of two or three is not going to matter. So
yeah.
So I just kind of like stopped counting and said, okay, here's a number. I don't have to, you know, think that hard to remember it. It'll always be there, and I'll just say it in a vague way, at least 35. And that way I don't have to start recounting stories to a doctor to prove to him that it's real. But yeah, and the way that you, there was some fuzziness as to how doctors.
Fuzzy. Hi, Fuzzy. Fuzzy's right here having fuzziness with catnip.
There was some fuzziness as to how doctors described concussions until just a few years ago. So I always went with the most conservative possibility. So I would require that I had either lost consciousness, had a massive headache the next day. There were several indications like that to verify that it was a memory loss, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it has produced some changes in my life that my family and I have had to adjust to. But I've been pretty fortunate in the way that I've dealt with it, and not, you know, like some people, Junior Seau is a very famous case, or, you know, Muhammad Ali. I'm much more fortunate than those guys were.
Yeah. So let's talk about what we're naming the cast, which is that the desire to beware of those in whom the desire to punish is strong. Do you want to read this thing? Read this section I just posted in the chat room about Goethe. It's kind of pronounced like the cheese. It's spelled Goethe, G-O-T-H-E. But read this from Johann Goethe. Read about him.
Okay. That's the Wikipedia post?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. That's it. That's
actually
right, baby.
I already had it up before you posted it
there. All right. Go for it.
Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, from August of 1749 to March of 1832, he was a German writer, artist, and politician. Now, let's see. I think, actually, Michael had a specific section highlighted. Oh, he did. Religion and Politics. Born to a Lithuanian family, Goethe's early faith was shaken by news of such events as the 1755 Lisbon earthquake and the Seven Years' War. In July of 1782, he described himself as a non-Christian, non-un-Christian, and most decidedly, as non-anti-Christian, non-un-Christian, and most decidedly non-Christian. In the Venetian,
like the blinds.
Yeah. Epigram? Venetian epigram, is that right?
Sure.
Goethe listed four things to be disliked. Really? That's sad. Tobacco smoke, bugs, garlic, and the cross. I like garlic, especially with bugs.
Do you like the cross?
I don't have any particular use for any religious symbology.
I've always thought the cross is really... I have problems with it. I mean, it's a torture instrument that you wear as jewelry to show your love. It's weird.
I know this is sort of been memed to death, but I've kind of always felt this way. Like, if I had been tortured to death on a cross, the last thing I'd want is for all the people in the world who want to remember me for my suffering to throw that cross in my face every time I look at them. It's like, thank you. That was the most painful moment of my life. Thanks for reminding me about that.
Yeah, and I came up with something that should be memed but isn't. But it could be still. Maybe it'd be a good Crazy Rich meme. Is if Jesus had died today, Christians would be wearing little drones around their neck.
cold, Michael.
It's probably true, man.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
And just as a reminder, Jesus was killed by the state.
After a fair trial by soldiers and cops who were only following orders.
And it might be also added that the majority, it was actually offered to the people to release Jesus because it was a specific day when they released one prisoner a year. And so
is that where the thing of the president pardoning a turkey comes from? I've always thought that was really sick. And I think that governors and presidents being able to pardon people is really sick, too. I mean, I'm sure if I were in prison for life for something I did or didn't do and a governor or president pardoned me, I wouldn't say, I'm an anarchist, I'm going to stay in here. But I really think that the power to be able to, it's the power of life and death. It is literally, you know, no matter what you did, a governor or president can say, okay, you're out. And it's really, I'm really curious who Obama's going to pardon his last week, because that's when presidents do it. And they pardon really weird people. Like George Bush pardoned a cocaine dealer, you know, and he's really pro-war on drugs. But I'm wondering what the guy had done for him, and nobody knows, you know. So who knows?
The very existence of the presidential or gubernatorial pardon proves that the system has nothing whatsoever to do with justice. Because really, if you think about it, if this person went through the trial, had a jury trial, went through all the processes, was found guilty, put in jail, then either the system works or it doesn't work. So if the system works, nobody, president or whatever, should be able to interrupt that and say,
right.
All that stuff was wrong, this guy needs to be out. But the fact that he can interrupt it means that it's flawed. So either way you look at it, either he should have the right to do that, well, then that proves the system's flawed. Or he shouldn't have the right to do that, well, then that proves the system is flawed.
Yeah, and I like to approach things from the system is flawed, but in an anarchist way instead of the way minarchists do, where they say it needs to be fixed. I find a lot of anarchist literature and media concentrates too much on the moral problem with the system. Because a lot of people aren't ready for that yet. And a lot of people can much easier take the step to, this will never work. This is unsustainable. And then later, maybe get the moral part of it or maybe not. And there's a meme going around now, something about, it's some prominent bowtie libertarian economist, but I don't know his name, but I like what he said. It was something in the effect of, the fact that politicians are always saying they want reform, educational reform, healthcare reform, et cetera, is proof that they didn't get it right the first 50 times around. Now, that's funny, but I would say that's not really the reason that they constantly want reform. I think the reason they constantly want reform is where they want it to end up, they could never get away with starting at that point. So they have to increment, they have to, you know, camel the nose under the tent and incrementally get to where you're going. And something we haven't talked about is that right now, as we are speaking live, the U.S. Senate is meeting and trying to take a vote on gun control. They're probably not going to succeed because they don't have the votes for it. And there are a few Republicans jumping ship for it. But I want to talk about one particular person who really has an urge to punish, who I think is the hypocrite of the year. And that's saying a lot for politicians. It's this guy, Joe Manchin. You know who Joe Manchin is?
He's the West Virginia scum that is betraying the people that he claims to be protecting and standing for in West Virginia.
Yeah, he's a Democrat senator who was reelected or elected, I'm not sure which, a couple years ago, In the kind of the height of the whole Tea Party, Fox News, you know, the federal government is the enemy, we need to take back the Constitution kind of thing. You know, it was mostly Republicans, but there were a couple Democrats jumping on it, and he was one of them. And he made a YouTube video, which was him with Obamacare. He's a Democrat. He was him with Obamacare, you know, in the state that probably has the worst health care and the fewest number of people who can see doctors of any state. You know, the way you get votes in that state is say, we don't want your free health care, which, you know, who wants it anyway? It's going to destroy everything and make it hard for everyone to see a doctor. But he got elected largely on a video he did on YouTube of him shooting the Obamacare bill, the actual paper, the printed out 1,000-page bill, shooting it with a deer rifle at like 20 paces, you know, basically shooting the president symbolically and saying, like, we don't want Obamacare. Here's what I think of Obamacare. And he shot it with a 30 caliber bullet at 20 paces, which would be lethal for any human. And, you know, I really think that his, I guess it was his intention. I don't know. I believe that a lot of his voters who voted him in said, oh, he wants to kill the president, which is, I can't believe that a U.S. senator got elected with that as his campaign video, but he did. It's shocking. I don't want to kill the president. I want the president to just go away. I want the president to live a happy life as a private citizen with his wife and his kids. I want him to, I'd even be happy if he took government money to do it and just went away. But you know, the thing with those people, I wouldn't be happy if he took government money, but I'd be happier than if he kept doing what he did and the position became vacated instead of being replaced. The problem with like wishing dead of those people is they're always replaced. They're like amoebas. Like everybody was hooting and hollering this week because Maggie Thatcher died, like ding dong, the witch is dead. And I'm like, have you seen England lately? Have you seen the politicians in England? She's not dead. Her body is dead, but her thoughts and actions and deeds live on stronger than when she was around. So I'm amazed that Joe Manchin ran on this, you know, gun, macho, I don't know, macho Republican flash with a deer rifle as a Democrat in West Virginia, shooting Obamacare with a deer rifle, and got elected. And right now, probably this moment, he is standing up in Congress, in the Senate, arguing long and hard of why we need to register guns. So basically his message, if you take it from back then and now, is, yeah, we will shoot the government if we don't like it, but only with guns registered by the government.
To paraphrase George Thorogood, he needs to let his hair grow and get a real job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually saw a Rastafarian, a Jamaican Rastafarian, screaming at some cops outside a Dead Show in Berkeley while the cops were arresting a guy for pot. And it was like 6'4", really tall, lanky Rasta dude, you know, not a white Berkeley Rasta, but a real Rasta from Jamaica, following these cops and yelling at him and saying, Hey man, why don't you get a real job? Why don't you come down to my office Monday. I give you a job selling incense. It's really funny, man. And
respectable job, producing something, selling something, providing a service.
And actually offered them a solution. I like that. I wouldn't hire an ex-cop, but he would, apparently, if they would become ex. So Joe Manchin also stole that idea for that video from my state rep. And I'm not saying mine, like I own him, but he's actually a shooting buddy of mine. It's that guy named Gerald Gay, who I don't like politicians, and I really don't like his politics, but I like him as a guy. I've hung out with him. He's been to my house several times. I've been to his house a few times. We've gone out shooting a bunch. And he made a couple videos. I actually made a campaign commercial for him, and he paid me $1,000 to do it, and it helped him get elected. And then I went from minarchist to anarchist and decided I would never make a political commercial for anybody in politics again. I only make anti-political commercials. And he offered me more than that to make one for his reelection 2 years later, this past year. And I said no. And, you know, if I were starving, my integrity might have been really challenged. I might have debated a lot harder. But I wasn't rich, but I wasn't poor. And at that moment, I just said no without any hesitation. Said no, I'm not doing political ads anymore. But, you know, good luck with your endeavors. But he ran against a Democrat who was a gun hater on a single issue message of I like guns and won. And that's how you do it in Wyoming. And I guess that's how you do it in West Virginia. But he made these videos about 6 months before the Joe Manchin video, Gerald Gay did, where he was shooting metal targets that he'd painted with temporary paint on them, hope and change. And he said, it's him with what I call an assault revolver. It's a Smith & Wesson 500, which at the time when it came out was the most powerful handgun in the world. Now there's the Casull, but the 5.45 Casull, but you know, Dirty Harry, they said the 350, the 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world. It may have been at the time, but at the time he made this, well, not the time he made this, the Castile is the most powerful handgun in the world now, but the Smith & Wesson 500, I fired his gun that he used in this. He loaded six shots into it, handed it to me. I fired one shot, and my hand stung so much, I handed it back. And I didn't limp wrist it, man. I held it well. And, I mean, it's almost like a 12-gauge shot shell in the kick, in a handgun. And he did this rapid-fire thing where he shot the two targets at about 30 paces pretty well. He's a good shot, really good shot. He likes to skeet shoot with a 22, which I won't go into, but about whether that's wise or not, because bullets do come down. But he's good at it, and he does trick shooting. Like, you know, he'll put a can on top of another can, shoot the can on the bottom, and then while the can is flipping up in the air from the first bullet, he'll hit the second can, things like that. And he did this video where he was shooting targets that said hope and change. And he said, well, sir, when you've got forced healthcare, what you've got is socialism. And he shoots the two targets, and that's the end of the video. And that is where Joe Manchin got his idea from, because that got blogged on like the Huffington Post and on a bunch of right-wing blogs. So it got like 40,000 hits or something. And then there was he actually got that from a movie called Used Cars. You ever seen that movie Used Cars from the '70s?
It seems familiar, but I can't place
it. It's got what's his name that's in Escape from New York.
Oh, that's right. I know that. Yeah. I know the movie now.
Yeah, it's
basically where the two competing car dealerships mm-hmm.
across the street yeah. from each other, and there's a scene where one of them does a TV ad where he goes into the other guy's yard, you know, sales yard, and climbs up on one of his used cars and says, well, when you've got a problem, I don't remember what he says, but he says something like, when you've got this, I'll tell you, sir, you've got that. And then he shoots the car, the price tag on the front windshield of the car, and blows the windshield out. And that's what Gerald is imitating in his commercial. The, well, sir, when you've got this, you've got socialism. And then Joe Manchin just ripped off the idea of shooting something to make a political commercial. And, you know, basically saying, I love guns, I don't love the federal government. And right now, as we speak, he is in a session of Congress, you know, pleading for people to let the federal government take guns, basically. And of course he says, we don't want to take your guns, we just register them. But, you know, I don't even have to go to saying, well, that's how they took them away from the Jews in Nazi Germany and ended up with everybody in the camps. I can go to New York State, because right now in New York State, they are violating a federal law, HIPAA, the protection of health records, to go through and see who has gone to a psychiatrist and said, I'm depressed, help me. And they're taking those people's guns away. That's happening right now. So the government is violating the law to enforce something that's not even a law. Well, it is a law, sort of, but, you know, that's what they do, man. That's what they do. So, Joe Manchin, you are the sellout hypocrite of the month in a galaxy of hypocrites. I mean, being the brightest star in that constellation is quite an act, quite a feat.
Yeah. You know, but what do you expect from a politician? First off, he's not going to think of anything new. He's got to rip off somebody else for it, because he's never had an original idea in his life. And second, you know, he's as shallow as a mud puddle, and anything that he says you can assume is a lie by the very fact that he's saying it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I don't know.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead. No, you.
Well, you mentioned the law, and I put a Somali proverb in the chat line that says, one may change their religion, but one cannot change the law. And this was an old tribal proverb that goes back in Somalia for ages. And the idea was, you know, among native people like that, law is a set thing that never changes. It's never adjustable. Everyone understands it, and no one can add to it or take away from it. But in the United States today, we have over 500 people who it's their daily job. They're called lawmakers, and it's their daily job to constantly make and modify law. And you just think about the contrast in that.
Yeah, law means immutable. Law means the word, you know? And really, the only word is The only word.
Bird is the word.
The only word is the non-aggression principle. But let's talk a few more minutes about the topic, and then we're going to end a little early today. The topic is, beware of those in whom the desire to punish is strong. I mean, that kind of sums up all statists, you know, especially like if you look at an example is comments on some article in the newspaper, on the website for the local newspaper, anywhere in America, where somebody's caught doing something that isn't a crime, you know, shouldn't be a crime, like having a bunch of a substance, or in New York State having a gun with a normal amount of bullets. If you look at the comments, about half of them are going to be like, throw away the key. I mean, literally, like the people are already judge and jury and executioner from reading an article that's biased by nature, you know, written by an arm of the state, the local newspaper. And they want to punish the person. And they make jokes like, you know, don't drop the soap. They want him to be raped in prison. They want to punish him. They want the state. I think it's partly because the state makes people feel so powerless that they want to endorse or participate in some of the state's violence to feel powerful. I don't know, man. What do you think it is? What do you think it comes from?
I think so, too. I think it's sort of a almost like a feeding frenzy when someone is offered up. You know, I think of the drawings of the like Mayan temple or whatever, the pyramid, and the blood coming down, or maybe it's not Mayan, maybe it's somebody else, but they're pretty much all the same. Any government eventually bleeds over to this point. But the blood is running down the pyramid, and the priest is standing at the top with a knife in his hand, and the victim's chest is laid open, and his heart is there, and all the people are cheering because there's a feeding frenzy that comes in, and once everybody can see that here's the bad guy, let's pull him apart, let's tear him apart. And the flip side of that, and I think I mentioned it not long ago in a podcast, the flip side of that is that when it turns on the dictator and they're doing that same thing to the dictator, it's still wrong. It's still the same. Motivation behind it.
Bloodlust.
Yeah, it is. And then they'll rip that dictator apart and hang him by his ankles and beat his dead body or whatever they're going to do. And then they'll just put another one in his place. It's really sad.
That's all I got, man. I think that's a good place to end. That's the state. They want to beat you to death and then replace you. You know, if you're a citizen, they want to beat you to death because I think it's a fear of death. I think it's, well, I'm not the one being killed today, so I'm going to cheer louder to get that guy killed. And
I think you're onto something right there, Michael, because that's, if you go back to pagan rituals of human sacrifice, that's exactly what it is. The whole rest of the village is like, yay, I live another year.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you got it.
And that was actually the motivation behind some human sacrifice was we need to kill this person for the crops to grow so everyone can live. And I think there's still, I mean, I don't know if it's DNA, passed through DNA. I think it's more likely passed through society. There's still some of that in people. There's still a lot of that in a lot of people. But I guess the hopefulness that I'm seeing is on the comment boards, on media, you know, on local newspapers, national newspapers, and on national news sites, more and more the comments include a large minority, like 30-40% of people who just don't buy it to one degree or another. I mean, they might be Tea Party people. They might be minarchists. They might be leftist anarchists. They might be Occupy Wall Street people. But everybody has a complaint, and usually some valid complaints, about what the state is doing wrong in a given article. And when they try to put things through to the people the way they used to, where the TV would just tell you, well, we need to round up these Japanese people and put them in camps for our safety. And everybody went, yay, yay. I guess what the internet has done is it's allowed you to talk back to the TV. You know, and it used to be only crazy people talk to the TV. But now everybody can talk to the TV, and the TV actually listens. It doesn't listen, but it can hear you. You know, I mean, they quote tweets, they quote blogs in mainstream media, partly because the mainstream media is dying, and this kind of media we're doing is going to take it over. With that said, we're going to get on radio for the last 3 or 4 years that there is radio. I think the internet's going to replace it, but it's going to be fun and it's going to be a good ride. And if there's anyone out there who has experience doing cold calling, drop me an email and send me your resume and we'll talk. Thanks, Ben Stone.
One last thing.
Go ahead.
Since I distorted, George Thorogood's lyrics a minute ago,
right.
I'll distort the Doors lyrics. We got the guns and we got the numbers. We're taking over.
Yes, but our guns are peaceful.
Peaceful flower shooting guns.
Yes, I have flower shooting rifles that can shoot a rifle into a dinner plate at 500 yards. All right, brother man, peace.
Hey, take care of yourself, Michael.
Worms.
Good night, fiends.
Good night, fiends. Good night.
Worms.
Worms. All right. Hang on a sec. Stay on here with me for a minute. We should say goodbye to the people on the chat room. Say thank you, I think.
Yeah.
We're not saying the Freedom Fiends are the one true path to anarchist liberation, but it's a good one. If you want to put your voluntarist money where your mouth is, consider making a donation to the Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post. Then make a one-time gift via PayPal or set up a monthly contribution of as little as $3. Giving to the Freedom Fiends helps advance education of horizontal liberation throughout the world. The Freedom Fiends. We work hard, so send us some money.
Thank you for listening to the Freedom Fiends Agenda. We'll be back streaming live every Thursday from 4 to 6 p.m. East Coast U.S. time on Freedom Fiends Radio at freedomfiends.com. MP3 archives of all Freedom Fiends episodes are available free at freedomfiends.com. That's freedomfiends.com. Worms.
All right, that humming finally stopped. Got rid of that. All right, let me make sure the feed's back up. The auto feed. Let's see, 5. The episode starting now is called Status Think People Should Be in Jail for Being Happy.
That fits.
Related, yeah. Yep, it's on. All right, I'm going to go edit this. You going to be up for a while or not?
Probably, yeah.
All right, I got a lot of stuff to do, including putting boxes away and checking microphones in and things like that. And I have to edit this and put it up. But I'll probably try to call you in a while. All right, man?
Okay.
All right.
Let's see. Probably my... What time is it? Yeah, probably my cell phone would be better. I'm turning it on.
Well, maybe I'll just talk to you tomorrow because I need to eat. I need to do like 2 hours worth of stuff and you might be asleep then. So I want to just thank you for a wonderful show. And we will talk tomorrow, man. Hey, will you do me a favor? Will you blog this episode and the other episode of yours on your website?
Sure.
Okay, I'll send you a link to remind you. I'll send it to you.
You mean just like put a link over to your... To your thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to put them in the feed, you can, but I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'll just put a link, a sort of a blurb and links to both of them.
All right.
And that's what I'll put up for tomorrow because I'm not going to do a podcast tomorrow.
All right. Cool, man. All right. Take care, brother, man.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for everything yesterday, too.
Yep. Worms.
Bye.
Bye.
And now it's time for Freedom Fiends with Nima V and Michael Dean. Have you swallowed too much of the state's poison? The Freedom Fiends will stick their fingers down your throat and hold your hair back while you hurl. And here they are, Nima V and Michael Dean.
That's good. Why don't you do one more take of the whole thing? And I think we're good.
And now it's time for Freedom Fiends with...
That sounds a little drag queen-y and like wrestling announcer. Hi.
And now it's time for Freedom...
And now it's time for... More sing-songy. It's the first thing people are ever going to hear from us. It has to be upbeat and energetic.
And now it's time for Freedom Fiends with Nima V and Michael Dean. Have you swallowed too much of the state's poison? The Freedom Fiends will stick their fingers down your throat and hold your hair back while you hurl. And here they are, Nima V and Michael Dean.
Yay! Outtakes.
Inoculation from indoctrination.
That was good. Thanks, babe.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to bed now.